This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commmavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 336 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is Rob Mark, aviation journalist and publisher of the Jetwine blog.
Hey, good evening to everybody from Chicago, where, all right, I know we're not going to talk about the weather, but we had a really cool ice storm last night. Well, I won't go any further than
wonderful,
that.
Wonderful. Well, also joining us is Max Trescott, author and certified flight instructor.
Hey, hello, gentlemen. Nice to be back here again. I was at the headquarters of Virgin America last week, had a great tour of their headquarters, and also flew their A320 sim for a little bit. So that's what I've been up to.
Oh, very cool. Maybe we'll have time coming up to talk about that a little bit. You can give us some of your impressions of, I'm particularly interested in the simulator, so maybe we can talk about that.
Sure.
Our guest this episode is Don Sebastian. Don is president of Aviation Consulting Services Incorporated, and he performs flight tests and pre-purchase inspections, really of all sizes. He's done everything, I guess, from Boeings to J3 Cubs. He's also been an expert witness, giving testimony in court. He's ATP, AMP, CFII multi-instrument. Don's got more ratings than probably all of us combined. And we'd just like to welcome you, Don, to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Well, good evening, fellow aviators. It'd be real nice talking to you.
Don, I know that I guess you mostly focus on citations and hawkers. Is that right? But you've been involved with some of the AOPA sweepstakes airplanes.
Yeah, that's right. The Debonair they gave away last year, and 2 years ago, the Cessna 182. I did the pre-buy on both them planes for the AOPA. True, I do a lot of jets and turboprops, but it varies. I work word of mouth, so I get referrals from my prior customers. And 1 year, I did 25 MU2s, and wow. The last one I just did was a Challenger 605, a Bombardier Challenger. So it kind of varies.
All right. Well, we'll be talking about pre-buys and how you go about doing that and some of the experiences that you've had coming up. But first, we're going to start with some of the current aviation news from the past week. After that, we'll talk about flight testing and pre-buys with Don. And then Jamie Dotson provides this week's history segment. We also have an Australia desk coming up. Rob brings us an aviation minute. And we also have Juan Fernandez's last installment, the seventh and final installment of his Geeks on Ice series about aviation in Antarctica. And then we'll close out with just a little bit of the listener feedback that we've received in the past week. So we've got a full agenda here. So let's jump right into it. Is everyone ready?
Yep.
Yep. Ready from the West.
Well, let's start off with a little bit of an update on some of the recent aviation accidents. We've said Trans-Asia Airways. We're still kind of looking for more information on the Air Asia crash. We talked last week a little bit about the Cirrus parachute deployment. Rob, can you kind of maybe walk us through where we stand on these accidents?
On all of them right now in 10 seconds or less?
Right off the top of your head.
Actually, what's kind of interesting, we're going to talk about the Cirrus chute deployment because we had a reader kind of take us to task. And, you know, I think it, we're going to reexamine that piece we did on the Cirrus. But on the AirAsia one, of course, we don't really know a whole lot more than we did back in December. The Indonesian group has not been quite as forthcoming with information as the Taiwanese Aviation Authority has been with the crash of the ATR last week. Unfortunately, it's from the facts they've been releasing, it's beginning to sound pretty sure that the pilots shut down a good engine after they had problems with the right one. So they had trouble with the right one, and in their haste, they shut off the fuel to the left one, too, and turned the ATR into a glider. And, well, we all know how that ended, so it's not been real pretty.
And I guess there's no reason given for why they might shut down that second engine at this point, right? We just know that the second engine was shut down, and it's yet to be determined what the reasons were behind that, I guess.
Well, they've listened to the cockpit voice recorder, and all we know is that what has been released is that they started to pull the throttle back or the power lever back on the left one, which was the still the good one, gradually. They didn't just yank it into shutoff. Mm-hmm. It came back gradually, but I guess they were trying to balance off the asymmetrical thrust from the other side, because apparently the right engine didn't auto feather because it didn't actually quit. It just kind of rolled back, which is, and Don might know that better than I believe it's essentially the same thing as if they just kind of pulled the power back to idle. And of course, to the auto feather, it said, oh, I don't need to do anything. Engine didn't quit. So they had that big blade out there causing drag, and you got to be on the rudders real quick to keep that thing going straight.
All right. Well, maybe we can move on to the Cirrus. Rob, as you mentioned, one of our listeners wrote in to say that maybe we were a little bit too strong on speculation last week about the cause of that, and maybe we did speculate a little bit too much. What do you think?
Yes, actually, Chris wrote in and thought that maybe we speculated a little too much. Of course, that's a little difficult, kind of a finger to point at me, because I love to speculate. It's my life. But actually, I think his biggest concern was that it seemed as if we were pointing the finger at the manufacturer of tanks as the culprit, and not perhaps considering the fact that perhaps the pilot didn't quite know how to transfer the fuel. Although, honestly, Chris, I went back and looked. In fact, we'll put the preliminary report from that Cirrus accident, the one that went down in Hawaii, in our show notes for this week. But there really wasn't much to tell. And all we know is that the pilot was able to transfer fuel effectively until that point, about 3 hours outside of Maui. And then he said something happened. Now, we don't know what. That's going to be part of the investigation that the NTSB isn't probably going to tell us about right now. But yes, we have to be fair. It could just as easily have been pilot error, or it could have been some problem with mechanics, either in the tank itself or the pump or in the lines. I guess there are quite a few places along the way it could have been a problem.
Well, and there were apparently multiple tanks. What I just read most recently was that everything was coming fine from the one set of auxiliary tanks, which I'm guessing were the ones in the back seat, but that it was one in the very back in the baggage compartment that he couldn't get fuel from. And, you know, Rob and I both teach in Cirruses, and we know that if there's a problem in the rear compartment, you're probably not going to be able to get there from the front seat to do anything about it.
Are they going to bring this plane up from its position in the bottom of the water? Do we have any information about that?
I doubt it. I don't know how deep the water is out there, but it's probably pretty deep. And the airplane's, even if it's brand new, I'm sure the insurance company's not willing to spend the money to go out there and retrieve a Cirrus. I mean, if that were a brand new King Air 350, maybe. But even then, I'm not so sure. But it has to be worth a lot, because it would cost an awful lot of money to bring that up.
Yeah, I'm thinking of it from the standpoint of the investigation. Might that not, you know, kind of help identify the cause? Because it seems like there just isn't a lot of facts to, you know, arrive at a cause for this.
Well, wait a minute. Are you saying that – I'm sorry. Are you saying that when the pilot said, I didn't do it, you're saying that you don't believe him?
No.
Are you saying that –
I'm just saying that, you know, if there was a some kind of a fuel feed problem or something like that, that, you know, having the aircraft that you could examine would help with that investigation.
Well, it would. I'm just saying that the cost to retrieve it is probably not cost effective. But what do you guys think, Max or Don? I don't think they'd.
Oh, I agree. I don't think they'll go after it. I think that's going to become, you know, the most recent coral reef to form outside of Hawaii there.
Hmm.
Well, I think this is Don here. I think it's all in the pre-flight. Hopefully, all the tanks were tested with a little bit of fuel in them before we started off, just to make sure they all transferred and the engine kept running.
Don, if you have an aircraft like this that has gone in the water, is that salvageable or is that pretty much a write-off?
Well, it's salt water.
Yeah, yeah.
it's a fairly new airplane, a lot of composites, so. If it doesn't cost too much, a matter of fact, I'm almost dealing with one like that now, a Cessna Citation CJ3 that went in a pond. And it depends on the circumstance and how they pull it out of the water, because they could damage it, you know, bring it shipside.
Sure, they pulled Sully's airplane out of the water, but of course that the Hudson River is fresh water,
yeah.
So. I guess that made a difference.
And they knew exactly where to look, too.
They knew exactly where to look, yes. Exactly. Good point.
All right, well, our next story comes from Yahoo.com. This is Surviving a Plane Crash. Does where you sit make a difference? This comes up every once in a while. This talks about the Taiwanese crash and that there was some of the passengers who kind of changed seats at the last minute. And if they had not, then maybe they would not have survived and that sort of thing. But it brought up the issue in this article about does it matter where you sit on the plane? Are there some seats that are safer than other seats?
I think I want to get off that plane as soon as possible. When the AirAsia aircraft crashed at San Francisco International, almost 2 years ago, the pilot after the crash told everybody to remain in their seats. And, of course, shortly thereafter, a fire broke out. All I can say is, if they told me to remain in my seat, I would still be out the door before they could stop me. You know, I think we've read that you know, when a fire starts in an aircraft, you have about 90 seconds. I mean, you just got to get out of those airplanes as quickly as possible.
You tell me how it's going to crash, and I'll tell you where to sit.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, you don't know where.
Many years ago, the theory was, and I used to always sit in the back of the airplane because I felt it was more crash-worthy. You know, it took a little time for the cabin to collapse coming towards you. But once again, that theory is kind of shaky the way the accident's happening today. One thing I like to do is sit by the emergency exit, especially in icing weather when the plane's taxiing out, because usually the co-pilot comes back with a flashlight and looks at the wings. And if I see something wrong when he was de-icing the airplane, like white ice on the wings, you know, hot ice on blue ice on the edge of the wings, and he had to use a pick when he was de-icing it, I tell the co-pilot, that's not snow on here. That's, you know, let's get the ice before we take off. And
right, for and, sure.
And put my two cents into it. And I'm sure they don't always appreciate that, but self-preservation.
Well, in fact, the article mentions a study that was conducted by a professor at the University of Greenwich in London. And this was a study that looked at plane crashes, over 100 of them, and looked at the seating charts. And what it found was that people sitting in the rows closest to the emergency exit rows, they were much more likely to survive the crash. So I think this is supporting what you guys are saying, that, you know, if you survive the crash, the best seat in the house is the one that gets you out of the plane quickest.
And I just remembered when 9/11 occurred, they had announcements in the World Trade Center telling people everything is okay, remain where you are. And of course, the survivors were the ones that got the heck out of there anyway. So yeah. I think that's just a good rule of thumb, is even when everybody's telling you, oh, it's all going to be fine, you might want to be the first out the door and, you know, be safe.
You're not kidding. And then look at that ferry that happened last year. Wasn't that, where was that, outside South Korea somewhere? And all those kids were killed because they were told to stay where they were, and then they all drowned. I mean, just, and the ones that survived were the ones that said, I'm out of here, man.
Well, one of the things that we talk about with accidents lately, of course, is being able to locate the aircraft. We have an article from Aviation Today. ICAO Safety Conference proposes new aircraft tracking standard. So ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization, has made a recommendation, and this is for a performance-based tracking standard that uses, existing technologies and procedures and those that are planned. And this recommendation, part of it is that any aircraft flying in remote areas that aren't covered under air traffic control radar would report their position every 15 minutes. And they say this can be accomplished really through a couple of different ways. One is to use ADS-C, Automatic Dependent Surveillance Contract. And the other is ADS-B, Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast. So, Rob, do you want to kind of give us a sort of a reminder of what these ADS-C, ADS-B represent?
Well, let's just go back to one important point, I think, that we have to realize why this is even happening. This is a result, really, of the loss of MH370, which we're coming up next month on a one-year anniversary of the loss of that airplane, and we still have not found one piece of wreckage, not a seat cushion, not a suitcase, nothing. I'm starting to alter my theories about what happened to the whole thing, but we won't go down that road right now. Let's just say that ICAO has taken a year to get to a point where they said, we need to deal with this, and let's propose a way to use some satellite-based tracking and some of the other equipment that's already on an airplane to give us an idea of where these airplanes are. But again, it's only a proposal. It has not been it has not passed any of the individual state organizations. And when I say state in this context, we're talking about individual countries, actually. So even if ICAO says, man, we're for this, if the United States doesn't agree with it, or if Botswana doesn't want it, or if China doesn't want it, or Turkey doesn't want it, it's never going to happen. So we're still, a little, away from having this all organized. But the point is, it really shocked an awful lot of people last March when they realized that there are an awful lot of airplanes flying around the world that we don't know the precise location of.
Hey, Rob, I'm wondering, would this potentially help in those circumstances like, Southwest flying into Branson, Missouri, lands at the wrong airport, that way they could find the airplane?
somebody told me something about the Southwest. What was it? Oh, I know what it was. I ran into a Southwest pilot when I was going out to San Diego a couple of weeks ago, and he said, said some smart alecky thing about, just make sure we don't stop in Missouri or something. And he went, yeah. He said, you know how that happened, don't you? And I said, well, yeah, they looked at the wrong airport. He said, well, they were on a visual approach, and air traffic down there turned them away from both airports, kind of out over the darkness for traffic, and then turned them back toward Branson. And so I think they got disoriented is what this guy was trying to make me understand. And they saw an airport and a runway out in front of them. They went, oh, there it is.
Must be the place.
And they just bit the bone on that one, I'll tell you. And it's really a shame. But in answer to your question, Max, I think it might have possibly helped.
And I don't mean to pick on Southwest. I know this has happened to other airlines and other aircraft. So
yeah, it's never happened to me. I've never looked at the wrong airport. I mean, it's amazing how many people don't that fly, and they just, no matter how many of these darn reports they read, people still say, "Oh, I'm fine." That happens to other people.
Yeah, exactly.
Another item, speaking of ADS-B, AVWEB reports FAA amends ADS-B rule. Now, the FAA, they've corrected a final rule that was issued in May of 2010 on ADS-B requirements for general aviation. Max T., maybe you can tell us what this is all about.
Yeah, the original ADS-B rule came out quite a while ago. I guess it was back in 2010, and that's a new equipage requirement that says that all aircraft are going to have you know, $5,000 worth of equipment installed to transmit their location under the new system that FAA is deploying. And there's been one real problem with that, and the Experimental Aircraft Association has pointed out that the roughly 20,000 experimental aircraft, it wasn't really clear if they were part of this rule or not because of the way things were worded. Well, the FAA has finally gone back and clarified it to say that, yes, they are part of this, but they don't have to have TSO-certified equipment. Because they're experimental and there is no requirement for TSO equipment. So what that basically means is they will end up meeting the ADS-B requirement with equipment that's probably going to be half the cost or less than other general aircraft are going to pay for. So good for them. I mean, I think that's great that they'll be able to continue to enjoy their status of having non-certified equipment for anything.
And TSO meaning time since overhaul, right?
Exactly. No, I'm kidding. It's the technical standard order. I can't remember. I think that's what it is.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yep.
No, I always grew up with TSO in the engine world, meaning time since overhaul.
Yeah, I thought you were kidding me.
No, I'm serious.
That's not what that is in this case.
Oh, all right. Well, let's see. We've got a couple of technical kind of technology items. Maybe we can just run through real quick. We have Boeing's 777X wing plant sprouts steel. Well, the Boeing 777X wing is composite. The article headline talks about the facility being built to manufacture the wing for the 777X. Now, that had originally been planned to be manufactured in Japan, but Boeing changed their mind. They wanted to keep the technology in Washington State. Now, the interesting thing about this to me is the time and the money that's being invested here. It gives you an idea of why the prices of these kinds of jets is so high. This plant to build the wing, it's 1.3 million square feet. It's going to have 320-foot autoclaves. And if you're not familiar with composite manufacturing, you basically lay up the either in a hand or automated fashion the carbon fiber and the resin, and then you stick it in an oven called an autoclave, and you bake it, 120-foot ovens, three of them. And this facility is costing $1 billion to build and equip. So, again, this is just for the wings, but it gives you an indication of how much investment is required. I don't know, Rob, did that surprise you how much this thing was going to cost?
Well, I guess I was a little surprised they didn't send this to China. I mean, they could have done this for a whole lot less money. I mean, this plant over there, I mean, what would that cost? Maybe $800? I mean, really?
Yeah.
And if you locate it next to a middle school, you'd have free labor as well.
There you go.
You guys are terrible.
Oh, God. Okay, I know. We're going to get all kinds of hate mail for this. Don't blame Max T. It was my fault. So, it is amazing when you look at the fact that they're willing to invest $1 billion. However, my guess, too, though, is that there were some really difficult political discussions going on between the Americans and the Japanese, because I'm sure the Japanese were ready to invest a sizable chunk of money for this. And the fact that they're not going to get it, I'll bet didn't make them real happy.
Yeah. And if you don't have that technology currently, getting that contracted from Boeing, it represents a fantastic opportunity to learn composite manufacturing techniques. So, but I can see Boeing wanting to keep that because the wing obviously is a critical component of the airplane, and some people will say that's the most difficult part, where more of the engineering goes than most other parts of the airplane. But I can see why Boeing might want to keep that.
Well, I think the trade-off is probably going to be that they'll get fewer orders from Japan. I mean, those are typical the kind of quid pro quos you have if you build it here than our airlines will agree to buy many, many, many of your aircraft. I've seen that there were, about 300 orders for the 777, and only 20 are from ANA. And, you know, that's not what we typically expect from the Japanese airlines collectively when a new Boeing comes out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is, at least so far, proving to be a very popular aircraft in the Middle East, with actually Emirates having about half of the outstanding orders. So it's popular there. Qatar, Etihad, kind of round out the top three.
So is Emirates just poised to take over the world? I mean, it seems like, don't they also have most of the A380 production as well on order?
Yes, they do. They do. Yeah, Emirates is kind of becoming a real powerhouse in the commercial aviation business worldwide, for sure. One other tech item real quick, and that is from the Telegraph in the UK. Formula One technology to be used in jet engines. That's kind of interesting. They are looking to invest some money in a number of different projects in the UK to try to keep the UK is what they say in the article. Their number two position in aerospace. The Formula One technology comes from using McLaren's Formula One gearbox expertise for future jet engines. Now, I don't know if that's the gearbox technology for the fan, a lot of the Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan, or for there's another gearbox in the associated with the engine, but that's interesting.
Do you think that's the gearbox they're going to use to taxi with, so they don't have to burn fuel? I mean, I was intrigued that they're looking to use motors to drive the wheels, because obviously when jet engines are sitting idling on the ground, they're still burning about half the amount of fuel they'd burn at cruise. So that's very, very expensive. So that's a really smart idea to, you know, come up with a substitute so you don't have have to have the engines running as you're taxing.
Yeah, I like that idea a lot. I mean, certainly there's a weight penalty by putting electric motors on the landing gear, but still, when jet fuel returns to the prices that I'm sure it's going to return to, driving it by electric motors rather than the jet engines makes a lot of sense. So we'll put a link to this article as well as all the others that we've mentioned in the show notes. And you can take a look at those. Those will be at airplanegeeks.com/336. Again, we're speaking with Don Sebastian, President of Aviation Consulting Services. Don, again, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here. And I guess you're wondering what I do. Well, what I do is I help people decide whether or not to buy an airplane and at what price. So that means I squawk a lot, because the squawk, you know, is a defect. And it's my job to find all the defects in the shortest amount of time, hopefully the first day, and then I call the buyer and we decide where we're going to go from here with what we know already. So I create a squawk list that's many pages long, and I have various categories on them. First, there's the FAA regulation type squawks, and they're about expired inspections, inoperative equipment, improper paperwork or sign off of past work. And then the other categories of squawk like corrosion, delamination, defective components, and sometimes even the paint. If it's advertised with new paint, you might see the word fisheye or alligator describing the paints because it's advertised with brand new paint. So that would be defects in the paint. And many buyers don't realize it, but the FAA considers the owner-operator has primary responsibility for the airworthiness status of the aircraft. And that means you should know all the airworthiness directives, inspection repairs are signed off correctly. It also means you inherit all the responsibilities of the past events that were not correctly signed off.
Don, can you give us any ideas of the most common kinds of squawks? Are there some types of squawks that you see more often than others?
Well, yeah, actually, I start off, of course, with a flight test, and I try not to be pilot in command. I'm usually not, because I don't want to be accused of breaking the airplane. If it's a small airplane, the owner or the pilot, they're pilot in command, and I'm sitting there with my video camera documenting the engine gauges. So a lot of squawks, like in a little piston airplane, for instance, that has a constant speed propeller, which means the propeller changes pitch, a lot of times the manifold pressure gauge isn't indicating right. So I'll have to take that into account when we're checking the performance. And I could check that against the field elevation of the day and my altitude of the airport. And on a larger airplane, it varies. I kind of have to go through the logbooks first on a larger airplane. Before I even get started, I usually come up with some items of interest, and sometimes I ask squawks right in the office, because the FAA keeps a file on all the N-registered United States airplanes, and I always tell the buyer I'm going to go ahead and get the airworthiness file from the FAA, which is only $20 in my case. I get a discount for it, and sometimes the registration file. And in the airworthiness file, I'm going to find out all the modifications that have been done, but more importantly, I'm going to find out if there's any major repairs that have been done, because a major repair should be logged in the logbook as doing a repair like that with the 337 form, which is repair, but the owner only has to keep the documentation for it. In other words, the form itself, the 337 form, for 1 year, and he could throw it away. So the only place I'll find that is in the FAA file in a lot of cases.
So there's only a 12-month requirement to retain that form, huh?
Yes, and that's the FAA 337 major repair form. Now, the other form is the 337 alteration form, and that's a good form. We like that because that's all the improvements that have been put in the airplane, and that's required to be kept with the maintenance records of the airplane until that part or whatever the improvement is taken off the airplane. Then you could discard that paperwork.
Max Trescott, as an owner and pilot, these forms are very familiar to you?
Oh, boy. I would say that they're not as familiar to us as pilots as they are going to be to Don, as someone who deals with them day in and day out. Don, I did want to mention kind of a related aspect, and that's getting these airplanes safely home. I did a seminar which I called Buying an Airplane and Not Crashing on the Way Home. And I searched the NTSB database from 1999 to 2009, so a 10-year period, using the phrase recently purchased. And I found 66 fatal accidents and 100 non-fatal accidents.
Wow.
And what kind of advice do you give to people who are buying an airplane so that they don't have an accident on the way home?
My advice is what I do. I do a flight test first right off the bat. And I'm going to be testing the maximum performance of the airplane. And that's testing the engine out, make sure I'm getting 100% power. So in a piston airplane, that means noting how far down the runway you go, noting when you clear a 50-foot obstacle, in what distance. As a flight instructor, I'll sit down with whoever's flying the airplane, and we'll go over all the numbers, and we'll put that on a checklist. And then we want to see our rate of climb through different altitudes. And while we're doing that, we'll call up air traffic control to confirm our altitudes, make sure the mode C on the transponder is reporting correctly. And then when we get to our cruise altitude, we'll run at maximum power just for a few minutes. And I'll calculate what our actual true airspeed is, because with these older airplanes, the gauges aren't always accurate, and I might not be developing full power. And then in some cases, but the airplane is dirty or the paint is flaking off of it, that'll slow you down a little bit. So I'll take that into consideration. But a jet or a large airplane, this process is quite extensive. This flight test, instead of only taking a half a day altogether between the pre-flight, the ramp runs, the IFR check on the ground, the takeoff performance, getting to altitude, and trying all the various things on the airplane. But on a jet, this process takes the entire day. And a lot of times, we're landing in the flight test at nighttime. And that's good, too, because a lot of jets have all kinds of lights in the instrument panel, electroluminescent lights and all different things. Some of these electric luminescent circuit breaker panels cost $10,000 to $20,000 each. So we're checking all these things.
Don, are the seller or the buyer involved in this pre-flight or a pre-buy process, or they you leave them at home?
No, I welcome them. The more eyes, the better. And my communication is much easier with the buyer being right there. Otherwise, I'm walking around and with my computer speaking into it, right, taking pictures of everything I see that I have to investigate, doing video of the motion stuff. For instance, if a jet's on the ramp and it has regular rubber leading edge boots on it to break the ice off the wings, I have to have one engine running, and I have to have the boots deflate with one engine in the proper sequence. I have to run my hand over them to make sure there's no holes in the boots where they're leaking air. And of course, leaking air isn't too bad, but when they deflate, they suck in moisture, and the moisture clogs up the various valves. And if it's a bigger jet, it has an alcohol type of system called TKS, and I have to throw that on the ground and make sure it goes all the way to the edge of the wingtips and the edge of the horizontal stabilizers. So a jet, this pre-flight and flight test is an all-day affair. But on a piston airplane, because I take an airline, the first flight out in the morning, usually 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, I usually get to wherever I'm going before noontime, and I can do the flight test and report back to the owner, we have serious problems here. We don't have serious problems. We should continue with the inspection. Before I fly in a piston airplane, I want to check the compression. Now, it takes quite a few hours to do a compression check. So I used to fly a J3, and we didn't have a starter, so we had a hand prop it. So I let the owner start the engine, and then when he starts it, I'm looking at the exhaust pipes, because if white smoke comes out of the exhaust pipes, there's probably oil laying in the cylinders. That could be leaky valve guides. And then I let him shut the engine down with the magnetos to make sure the engine doesn't start when I hand prop it. And then I hand prop, if it's a four-cylinder, I count to four several times. If it's a six-cylinder, count to six several times. If I find a weak cylinder, I don't think I'm going to fly. I'm going to do a compression check before I fly. I try to identify why that cylinder is weak. Now, on a jet, I don't have to do that. But if traffic allows, if we do a maximum power check on the runway before takeoff, and if it's a busy airport, we have to do that in the run-up area.
Don, did you ever discover something in this process that was kind of completely unknown and a big surprise to everyone involved?
Oh, yeah. It's about 1 out of 10 airplanes I find serious problems where I don't want to fly in it, really, until we look into it or fix it. Well, I'll give you example, you know, if like a twin engine turbocharged airplane, I'm expecting to see the manifold pressure come up, you know, to where it's supposed to be. And if the gauge sometimes sticks and the manifold pressure doesn't come up, I have an agreement with the pilot in command that if I say abort the takeoff, I don't want to fly an airplane. And you don't know if it's just a gauge or if you're lacking power from that engine. So there's a lot of things that could come up, and I'll give you an extreme example. I had a three-year-old Learjet, a Lear 31, back in the mid-90s, and a contract crew came out to fly it, and they were very competent guys, and I sat down with them for 45 minutes. And we went through the mission profile. We had to go up to 51,000 feet. We had to do all this stuff and various things going to do along the way. I'm going to check make sure the pressurization's working on the left engine and the right engine and this and that and the other thing. So at 51,000 feet, we got up there in 18 minutes. And it didn't dawn on me. That's pretty quick, 18 minutes. Yeah. I thought it was going to take like at least 20 minutes. Anyway, they set the power, and I got it all on videotape, and we set the torque. The fan speeds were good, but most importantly, the fuel flow was where it's supposed to be. So we're using the right amount of fuel for the speed for maximum power, and we were accelerating. And it takes a while to accelerate, so I go in the back of the airplane. We're pressurized at 9 psi pounds per square inch, and I'm listening for any unusual noises and whistling sounds where it might be a pressure leak in the fuselage. Because one time I found a crack in the rear bulkhead doing this. That could have been serious.
Yes.
But anyway, I'm back there. I'm back there, and I ask them to check the fan and turbo sync, because when they turn that on, the light comes on, and they say it's working. It's the only way you really know it's working is if you get back where the engines are and you can hear it syncing. So then I'm coming forward, and I just get to the cockpit, and of course, there's a pilot and co-pilot up there doing a great job flying the airplane, with the airplane tucked under high-speed Mach at 51,000 feet, which means the sound barrier moved up on this subsonic wing. The sound barrier moved up and blocked the air going over the leading edge. And the plane vibrates and points down. That's not good. But fortunately, I had a block altitude from 51,000 to 40,000 feet. I always make sure we have block altitudes because we are testing the airplane. And so the airspace was all ours, but we were going down fast, and the crew was rapidly reduced to power. And we were accelerating, and I was afraid we were going to rip the wings off. I just mentioned drop the landing gear. That's the only thing I could think of, and they thought of that too at the same time, and they were reaching over, and then they recovered by reducing the power. That worked. They got right up to red line, but not much over it. So we get back on the ground, and I call the test pilots in Tucson, Arizona. And I said, you know, I can't figure this book out, this flight manual. I said, I don't see a supplement in here for thrust reversers, because our particular airplane doesn't have thrust reversers on it. And they said, we didn't make any airplanes without thrust reversers. Well, you know, yes, you made five airplanes without thrust reversers. And without thrust reversers, we got a better pressure ratio from the straight exhaust pipe, and we didn't have all that stuff hanging off the back of the exhaust pipe, the tailpipe of the airplane. So we went faster and higher, and the plane outperformed the manual. And even though the crew did exactly what they were supposed to do to get maximum performance, and all the gauges were right, the airplane just oversped. So they had to make a new flight manual for those five airplanes out there. So that was kind of a drastic thing.
Wow. Rob, sounds like Don's got an awful lot of experience here. Is this something that you could do with this with your experience, or do you think Don's got something really special going here?
Well, let's see. Max West, when was the last time you were in a jet at high altitude where you practiced Mach tuck?
Let's see. I don't think ever. Nope. Doesn't sound like any fun to me.
Did either, and I like it that way. I'd much rather listen to people like Don, to tell you the truth.
It's, well, you know, once in a while my job gets a little dangerous, but I really never had a customer crash that I know about. And I usually call them when they get back to their home airport. I mean, if they're with me, that's great. They could, you know, it's a small airplane and they're with me. They could sit in the co-pilot seat, because I'm very good in the back seat with my video camera going, because my job isn't to talk to air traffic control. It's not to fly the airplane. It's to find out what's wrong with the airplane and to prove it to the seller so we can either reduce the price or have them fix it before we buy it. Because don't forget, this is the only time in your whole life of airplane ownership that you're going to get free maintenance. Before you buy it.
Well, you know, this brings up an interesting question that I've always wanted to ask the right person, and I think you might be the right person, Don. Have you ever watched any of these shows on any of the cable systems, you know, Repo Man and all that kind of thing, where they go in and they repossess airplanes? And I've always thought, boy, if I were going to do that, the last thing I would want to do is steal somebody's airplane out of the hangar, having no idea whether it was airworthy or not, and just jump in the thing and go. I mean, I don't know. What's your thought on that? Do you think those shows are all just hooey or what?
Well, you know, they kind of suggest they're complying with the regulations, but it takes a long time to figure out if a jet airplane that's 10 or 15 years old especially is airworthy just by the paperwork. I mean, there's so many inspections. Some of Embry's light jets have 3,000 inspection items. If one inspection item is out of inspection, the whole airplane's not airworthy. So it's a big job, and I start that at home. On a jet, I say, okay, let's get the maintenance tracking program. It's called the CAMP, CAMP, and let me study that, and let me figure out what we got here and what's coming up, because if there's a major inspection coming up, we might want to make that part of the pre-purchase. And I'm not going to say pre-purchase inspection. Don't use that word inspection, because that's an FAA term saying that you're doing it in accordance with the manufacturer's instructions on a checklist and all. But, you know, if it's signed off correctly, I will take the word for it that the inspection was done correctly. What I'm looking for, I'm looking out of the box. I'm looking for things that aren't covered on that checklist. And performance-wise, like on the flight test. Because, you know, most pre-purchase inspections, they don't flight test the airplane. So how do you know all the avionics are working? I mean, you could hire an avionics guy to come and spend a few $1,000s to check everything out on a big airplane. But it's much easier in that hour and a half flight test to check the avionics out, make sure they're all working.
Don, last week we talked about one of our friends down under, Ben, who had just purchased a Cessna 172. And then flew it across one side of Australia to the other. Did you listen to that? And how did those how did those guys do? What was your opinion of that experience?
Well, you know, I sent you some information on SID. Cessna has this inspection program. Here's the thing: you don't want to spend a fortune inspecting the airplane and then have the seller tell you, "I won't sell it to you. It's too expensive to fix it." you don't get into that, those special inspection, like you don't start taking the engine apart before you go flying, because then you have to put it back together and sign everything off. And by the time you do all that, you're there for a whole day and you never even flew the airplane. You have to assume it's airworthy. But if he would have did a flight test, chances are those squawks would have showed up. You get into an airplane that you've never been in before, and maybe you took a demo ride in it with the owner or the pilot. You know, your eyes aren't focused. You go up there and cruise altitude, sit there for 2 hours, and you're going to find out a lot of stuff. Because my checklist is tailor-made for every airplane I fly in. So I'm checking every box. Does this switch work? Does that work? Does this work? Tune the radios in, and let's go across the waypoint. Let's see if everything points the right way. You know, there's all kinds of things to do. Try both transponders, make sure that air traffic control is reading them both. And there's systems in the airplane, especially in a jet airplane, you get to altitude. You want to make sure it's warm in the back of the cabin, because the owner's going to be pretty mad if he's up at 40,000 feet and the passengers are cold in the back of the cabin.
All right. Well, Don, we've got to move on. But before we do, I just wanted to ask you, when we were looking at some of your bio information, you listed some goals that you had, which I thought were kind of interesting. One of them was make 5 more airline pilots. Can you explain what that means?
Well, you know, back in the good old days, about 40 years ago, when a lot of my students, you know, had airline ambitions. And, you know, once in a while I walk on an airline, I see either the captain or the co-pilot or somebody I gave instruction to a long time ago. And, of course, with today, with what I'm doing right now, I'm not really giving instruction anymore. I will take instruction jobs if, for instance, you're starting a 135 operation and they need a ground school and stuff like that. But that's what I meant by it. It's very satisfying when you see some of the people that you taught how to fly, you know, move on and be successful in aviation.
All right, very good. Don, one other thing that we noted is that in terms of finding out some of the activities that you're involved in, some of the things that you're doing online, the best advice is to Google Don Sebastian Pre-Buy Aviation Consulting Services. And I did that, and boy, you show up in a lot of different places.
Well, unfortunately, I'm always behind the camera, not in front of it. So you don't really, you know, you see nips and nabs of what I do on that. But actually, it's a personal service I'm giving to a person. So for no charge, I want those persons to call me, 910-315-0099. call me on that number, and I'm going to spend a little bit of time on the telephone, a meeting of minds of what you expect, and I'm not going to kind of decide what airplane you should buy. You did all your market research. You know what airplane you want to buy, but I want to explain to you the maintenance and the chances of finding this or that, and we have to kind of get together and have a conference call before I go traveling with the seller, hopefully the mechanic who's been working on it or the last guy who did the annual inspection, and usually the salesman, the buyer, and myself, because now I have some data from the FAA on stuff, and hopefully I have a copy of the logbooks if it's a piston airplane, because anybody today can just snap pictures of the logbooks and send them to me. But if it's a jet airplane, I have all those computerized aircraft maintenance reports, and I can decide with the buyer how we're going to go about buying this airplane, what we're going to be doing, and what the indications are in the past, because I do a lot of online research, look for service difficulty reports. And by the way, that Ben there and who bought the 172, there's a few of those items I could eyeball doing a pre-buy inspection, but they really get into those items where you have to take the wings off to check things. Mm. Well, that shouldn't be part of a pre-buy. I mean, because you might spend $10,000 and decide not to buy the airplane. Right. I have to try to decide the first or second day if a fella can buy this airplane or if there's something seriously wrong with it, we should move on to another one. Hmm.
All right. Well, Don, thank you so much. Sounds like you've got a fascinating job, which I'm guessing that you enjoy enormously. And again, want to thank you for coming on the show.
Well, you're welcome. And you have my phone number. You may put that in the show notes, because I want to deal personally, a personal service to a person. I don't charge anything to talk to them and decide where we should go from here and what we should do and what the costs are.
All right. Absolutely. We'll put that in the show notes. Thanks again, Don.
Okay, have a good night.
And now Jamie Dodson is going to give us a report on an airplane of the week. This is the Avro Canada C-102 Jetliner. Here's Jamie.
This is Jamie Dodson with the Airplane Geeks Plane of the Week. This week we're featuring the Avro Canada Charlie 102 Jetliner, the jetliner that never was. On October 10th, 1949, at Malton Airport in Toronto, Canada, North American's first jetliner lifted off in a stiff crosswind. The C-102 flew flawlessly for 65 minutes, only 2 weeks after Britain's Comet jetliner became the world's first, and 5 years before the United States would fly the Boeing 707. The Avro Canada Charlie 102 jetliner could outclimb and outcruise any North American airliner on the drawing boards. It needed less runway than anything the airlines had in their fleets and could fly higher, faster, and cheaper. The airplane was coveted by at least six airlines, the U.S. Air Force and the Navy, the U.S. Civil Aviation Authority, and even billionaire Howard Hughes. Yet despite all this interest, 7 years later, the jet was put to the cutting torches. Its last earthly remains, its nose section and cockpit, sit forlornly at the Canadian Aviation Museum in Ottawa, and the rest of the pieces were sold for scrap. For those who have never heard of the C-102, here are some highlights. A jet-powered airliner prototype designed and built by Avro Canada Limited in 1949. It was the first Canadian jet aircraft to fly and the first jet transport in North America. It carried the world's first jet airmail on October 18, 1950, on the Toronto to New York flight. It took less than an hour and cut the previous record in half. Only one was made, and the program was canceled. It was flown and tested by businessman pilot Howard Hughes, and I'll get into that a little bit later. It's way ahead of its time. It was the first short to medium range jetliner. The next short to medium range jetliner did not go into service until 1959 with the advent of the French Caravelle. In 1945, Trans-Canada Airlines, or TCA, started exploring a number of aircraft developments under the direction of Jim Bain. Avro of England had recently acquired the Victory Aircraft Shadow Factory in Toronto and started exploring production possibilities with TCA for a twin-engine turboprop, much like the Vickers Viscount. In the fall of 1945, Bain traveled to England to visit various aircraft companies. During his exploration of Rolls-Royce Crisis Engine Department, he saw the early work for what was then known as the Alpha Juliet 6-5. The new engine, later known as the Rolls-Royce Avon, enthralled Brain, and his return to Canada, he changed plans for the Avon's development to use the two new engines and make a true jet airliner, vice a turboprop. Over the next few months, the teams at TCA and Avro refined the requirements, which were signed off on April 9, 1946. They called for a 36-seat aircraft with a cruising speed of 425 miles per hour, a range of 1,200 miles, an average distance between stops of 225 miles, and the longest single flight of 500 miles. The difference between the range and the maximum airport distances was to allow for the required 45 minutes stacking of air traffic controllers and the possibility of getting diverted up to 120 miles to an alternate airport. The aircraft also needed to be able to operate from existing 4,000-foot runways. The load was prescribed at 12,700 pounds and 50 passengers. The agreement also specified a number of contractual terms that, in retrospect, appear especially odd. In spite of TCA's experience with contracting for the Ministry of Transport and Bain's personal arguments that cost-plus contracts be used as a ward against budget overruns, TCA's contract with Avro demanded fixed prices for the entire development, as well as a fixed price for each of the aircraft at $350,000 Canadian. Additionally, Avro was not allowed to sell the aircraft to any other airline for 3 years. After that, if a buyer paid less than the specified $350,000, Avro would have to pay the difference to TCA. Furthermore, during the testing period of 1 year after the first aircraft was delivered, Avro would have to pay all costs, even if paying passengers were carried. Jack Diamond, chief of TCA's engineering department, suggested that Avro pay for the testing so that it would, quote, permit us to learn how to successfully operate a jet aircraft without having to pay for such experience the hard way. As with any new technology being introduced, this particular design had its share of issues. In December 1947, Fred Schmai, president of Avro, advised Herbert Smith Symington of TCA that they could not meet the fixed price contract. Symington's response was to pull out of the project, perhaps due to having successfully taken delivery of their new Canada North Stars. C.D. Howe stepped in and offered $1.5 million to continue the project, but at a slower pace. At about the same time, Rolls-Royce told Avro that the civil certification for the Avon could not be guaranteed in time for the jetliner's rollout. This, in turn, would lead to a higher operational and maintenance costs. Nevertheless, Avro continued with its plan to build the jet, selecting four Rolls-Royce Derwents to replace the two Avons. Chief designer James Floyd was upset by these developments, but in the end found a number of advantages to the four-engine layout. The main advantage was that in an engine-out situation, the aircraft would lose only one-quarter of its thrust as opposed to one-half, which made the power tolerances much easier to meet. In particular, the asymmetry in thrust originally called for a powered rudder to correct the yaw in the case of an engine out, but with four engines, it was found the yaw was so small it could easily correct it with manual trim controls. Although bearing some resemblance to the Avro Tudor 8 and 9, from the outset, Floyd's design was conceived as a commercial jetliner. The updated design was presented in October 48, and in February, the TCA responded with changes of their own. Now they wanted the aircraft to cruise at 500 miles per hour, and they increased the fuel requirements to allow for wider diversions. In April, McGordon Gregor got control of the presidency of TCA and told Smythe that he did not want to be the first airline with a jet. Nevertheless, the project pressed on and was the topic of a major article in Aviation Week that November. The aircraft was scheduled to begin deliveries in May of 1952, enter service in October, which would have given it 6 full years head start on the 707. During this time, the Cold War was starting to heat up, and the Canadian authorities were in the midst of expanding the military. Avro was involved in designing the first dedicated jet-powered, all-weather fighter for the RCAF, the Avro CF-100 Canuck. The project was somewhat delayed, although the companies continued to work on the jetliner caused some controversy. When the airliner arrived in New York after its record-breaking trip from Toronto with airmail, the flight crew was treated to a ticker tape parade down the streets of Manhattan. Airline executives and U.S. government officials lined up to see this magnificent airliner, and there was a great deal of interest. However, no firm offers came from the time that they sent in New York City. after the prototype returned without any immediate sales prospects, C.D. Howe, the Minister of Everything, ordered the program stopped in December of 1951. The second prototype jetliner, well on its way to the main assembly hangar, was broken up at that time. A few months later, the enigmatic Howard Hughes first learned of the design and leased the jetliner prototype for testing. He flew it for a few circuits around Culver City Airport after it arrived. He became a believer, imagining TWA and National delivering passengers from New York to vacation spots in Florida in half the time of the competition. He became desperate to buy 30 jetliners, but Avro had repeatedly turned him down due to limited manufacturing capabilities and overwork on the CF-100 project. Hughes then started looking at U.S. companies to build it for them. Convair proved interested and started studies gearing up for a production run. C.D. Howe again stepped in and insisted that Avro concentrate on its turbojet for the CF-100 fighter jet program. The project almost restarted in 1953 when the CF production was in full swing, but this never happened. In 1955, TCA ordered 51 Vickers Viscount turboprop aircraft. These were the first turbine-powered aircraft in regular service in North America, and they continued in service in 1974. This effectively ended TCA's interest in any way in the C-102. The prototype jetliner was later used as an aerial platform to photograph the CF-100 project. On December 10, 1956, the jetliner was ordered surplused, and though it was donated to the National Research Council, they had no room for it in storage and could only take the nose section and the cockpit layout. The rest of the jetliner was cut up on 13 December 1956. The only surviving parts are the nose and cockpit section in the Canadian Aviation Museum in Ottawa. There were several factors that led to its demise. Firstly, it appeared during the Cold War, and the Liberal government of Canada did not want the Avro Canada building anything other than the CF-100 fighter. Next, Rolls-Royce canceled their RB-102 jet engine, and Avro was forced to adopt less powerful alternatives. This reduced range, speed, and payload, and many of the airlines lost interest. As an aside, the Orenda PS-13 Iroquois, designed for the CF-105 Mark II, came to being because Rolls-Royce canceled the RB-106 engine before production. In my opinion, the only thing that kept Canada from beating the U.S. and most of the world to a jet airliner was Canada. I'd like to take a second to thank David for inviting me to sit in for him for a few weeks while he's down for maintenance. You may have heard from last week's show that he's had some medical issues. Well, we hope and pray that you come back soon, David, and take over your role as the Chief Airplane Geeks Historian and the walking encyclopedia of all things aerodynamic. This is Jamie Dotson reporting from Huntsville, Rocket City, and 3-Mike-5 Moontown Airport.
Thanks, Jamie. Boy, what a fascinating aircraft. And I think it's kind of a good-looking airplane as well.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that it came out 7 years before the 707. I mean, that's pretty amazing to think that it was that early in the evolution of the jet age and yet somehow couldn't make it to market.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we want to thank Jamie for doing that. Of course, Jamie, you can find him at nickgrantadventures.com. If you're not familiar with Jamie's work, he writes adventure novels, usually involving flying boats and that sort of thing. So, yeah, check that out.
I wish I could think of the name of his young character off the top of my head because I've read a couple of Jamie's books, but I can't.
You mean Nick Grant?
Yes.
That would be it.
Did you say that?
I did, because that's the website.
Right, okay. Okay, so I don't listen either. Okay,
well. Okay, all right.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 9th of February, 2015, and yeah, I'm back, all right. Yeah, I didn't totally break it. It was just the radiator, and we had to replace it. In my defense, 360,000 kilometers in that vehicle, and finally the radiator goes right when I'm driving it. Yeah, go me. Hi, Steve.
You've had a whole week to rehearse that. Welcome back, folks, to the Australia Desk for episode 336. Now, Grant, you've broken another car.
It's not my fault. We have lots of old vehicles in the fleet, and I keep getting to drive them.
Well, like Ben said on last week's segment, I'm glad he hasn't bought an aeroplane.
Hey.
Well, I know an airplane you could buy. Qantas is retiring a lot of 747s at the moment, mate.
Oh, a lot of them? I thought they were just retiring one particular one.
They are indeed. In fact, Oscar Juliet Alpha, OJA, which was in fact the first 747-438 to come into the Qantas fleet way, way back in 1988 or 89 or somewhere back there. A long time ago anyway. I think I'd not long left high school when this aircraft came into service.
This was the one that did the non-stop arrival flight from London.
Actually, this record still stands today. It flew non-stop from London to Sydney, which is 18,001 nautical miles, in a time of 20 hours and 10 minutes. And that's a heck of a record, Grant. Gee whiz, they'd want to have some pretty good meals on that aircraft.
Well, I've actually read the story of how they did it. There was a lot of planning. They had special high-density fuel to help make it happen. They calculated it to within an inch of the nearest weight that they could get away with. The crew were limited in what they were allowed to bring. There was a couple of reporters and VIPs on board who were limited in what they were allowed to pack. It was right down to the wire, and they were very lucky that they got great air traffic control support right across the world, and they were cleared into areas and other aircraft were like, hey, why can't we get that? To which the answer was, you're not going as far as these guys. And it was a one-off thing, but it got everyone's attention. It was kept very well under wraps. They were very concerned that the word would get out, and there was all sorts of secrecy around it. But yeah, flew from Washington to London, got everything set up, and away it went.
Now, that's all really cool, Grant. In fact, looking at some of the history of this aircraft on one of my favorite airplane geeks websites, AussieAirliners.org. Interestingly, Grant, during its career, it's actually been wet leased to the former Ansett Airlines briefly, which I thought that was interesting, to cover the loss of one of their Boeing 747s temporarily. And then it came back into Qantas service, and it's been operating all these years, Grant. But unlike most of the other Qantas 747 fleet, which, you know, I think there's probably more Qantas 747s sitting out there at Victorville in the boneyard these days. This one's going to a rather more unique place, and it's really cool, actually.
That's right, mate. It's going to do a very special retirement flight, a really, really long one. It's going to take off from Sydney and land almost next door, just down the hill at Wollongong in the Illawarra area, and it's going to go and park at the Historical Aircraft Restoration Society, aka HARS.
Qantas have another 747, an older one, up there at the Founders Museum up there in Longreach in Queensland. So, they've proved that they can get the aircraft into these shorter runways, and there's a lot of simulator training, we believe, going on. And at the moment, no official date has been set for its arrival down there into the Illawarra Regional Airport just south of Sydney, but the early mail we're hearing is about mid-March, I think. And Grant, I think we're going to have to get on a Qantas plane or any other plane that can get us up there, because I think we need to be there to watch this momentous arrival.
It could be pretty good to see. The hard bit's going to be getting the right day, because they need a minimum headwind coming down the runway for them to actually make the approach and land successfully. And apparently it's going to have the cabin stripped out. That'll be shipped down by truck to be put back in once it's landed. So they're really cutting it right to the bone on this one. And it's getting a lot of comments. There's a few people who'd rather see that it actually went to the Longreach Qantas Founders Museum. But, I think it's going to be pretty good down at Illawarra. I'm still not sure exactly where they're going to park it, because when HARS get all their aircraft out, there's not a lot of tarmac left. So adding this one, it's going to pack the place out.
Yeah, very true. But I tell you what, it'll be spectacular when it goes down there. And really good of Qantas to, consider doing this. This aircraft was originally scheduled to make its way across to retirement in Victorville back on December the 8th, but they kept it in service for a few more flights. It's operated across to Johannesburg a few times, I believe, and also up to Japan, I think, somewhere up that way. Anyway, somewhere up in Asia. And so it's still been doing the work. And at the moment, it's currently sitting at Sydney Airport. But good on Qantas and HARS for making that happen. I think it's very important.
Oh, mate, I think it's going to be pretty good. And I wouldn't half mind being on it, because I reckon she's going to climb like a homesick angel. But the only problem is she won't be allowed to climb too high, because she'll have just started climbing and it's time to start getting into the pattern for Wollongong just down the hill.
Yeah. They say wheels up, wheels down. Do you reckon they'd even bother putting the wheels up? I don't know.
Oh, no, they'll put the wheels up and then, stooge it down there. But yeah, it's going to be fun.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, we'll report on that a little bit more. Hopefully, we'll be able to cover the arrival of that, because I think that'd be really, really cool. Now, Grant, let's talk about Qantas's competitor, Virgin Australia. They're doing some interesting things over there in New Zealand. Well, sort of, Grant, I guess from a business standpoint.
Yeah, well, they're consolidating their air operator certificates. They currently have one in New Zealand that's used to operate Pacific Blue. So you had Virgin Blue in the old days, and then they started doing some flights around the Pacific, and they called that enterprise Pacific Pacific Blue. It was based out of New Zealand using New Zealand registered aircraft and so on. And they've got 10 737-800s over there. Well, as part of their consolidation and cutting costs and so on, they're going to shut down the New Zealand Air Operators Certificate, and those 10 aircraft are going to come back into the Australian register, and they'll be doing Pacific flights from within Australia.
And interesting here, Grant, this article I'm reading here in australianaviation.com.au says they're also going to reconfigure those 10 aircraft from their current 180-seat premium economy layout to the standard 8-seat business 168-seat economy cabin that's standard on all the rest of the Virgin Australia fleet. Granted, I note with interest that the last red paint painted Virgin Blue aircraft has finally been painted white in the new Virgin Australia livery. I'd say the new Virgin Australia livery, but I think it was about 2011, wasn't it, when they changed that name over?
It does seem to have been a while, but it has taken them quite a number of aircraft to get through. Some people are saying they're upset to see the premium economy go. I don't know. I quite like the business class up in these aircraft. I've managed to fly in it quite a number of times and definitely enjoyed it. But look, we'll see how it all comes through. They're still going to fly the same routes, which do include New Zealand and up to the Pacific and so on, but I'd say they're just going to fold it into the Virgin Australia International Airlines AOC, which is also the one they use for the 777 operations.
Yep, and all this is made possible by an open skies agreement, which allows, actually it's been in effect for this part of the world at least since 2007. So, this is how this is possible. It allows New Zealand aircraft to recognise Australian AOCs and vice versa.
That's the one, mate, that's the one. But hey, you know, speaking of open skies, there's a little bit of open skylarking perhaps going on in this rather tongue-in-cheek article.
Well, and now, Grant, this is a really interesting, and now everybody's heard of this newspaper, haven't they, Grant? The Batuta Advocate, I think that's how you pronounce it.
The Outback Onion.
Sounds like the Outback Onion to me. I don't think this is anything more than satire, but there was an article that came out this week talking about a pilot up in the Northern Territory who was apparently allegedly arrested after defacing Ayers Rock, or Uluru, in a deeply offensive stunt, according to this newspaper. Someone says that this person tried to land his light aircraft on it. I have my doubts, quite frankly.
Yeah. Having seen photos of the top and spoken to people who have been on the top of Uluru, mate, it's not exactly flat. It looks flat from a distance, but once you get up to it, it's quite lumpy. And I think he wouldn't have left two long black marks on the surface of the famous landmark, as per the article. I think he would have left bits of landing gear and half his aircraft up there. But I love the comments from a Dale Wap Jones, a cleaner at the nearby Ayers Rock Resort, saw the action unfold. He's coming in hot, like real hot. He done flying right over my head and straight for the rock. It's like, okay. And apparently he heard the squeak from the tires when he put it down. So yeah, he's doing pretty well because the rock's pretty bloody high. So I don't know how he managed to hear that squeak all the way down on the ground.
Yeah. Now, we only mentioned this article because it's been doing the rounds in some of the aviation press this week. I think it's nothing more than satire myself, but
it's absolutely hilarious.
Well, the article itself is not so funny. It's all the comments that are below the article that I find quite funny. But anyway, folks, if you're interested in more like a bit of a laugh, we'll put that link in the show notes.
I think Outback Onion's a good description for this this magazine. They you look at some of the other articles on it and they get up to a fair bit of mischief. But yeah, some people have obviously believed it was right, and there's some professionally outraged people there getting a little outraged. So.
Yes, well, Grant, don't get me started on those type of people. I think we ought to sign off here. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran. Oh, hang on, Steve. I just got to take this call. Hang on. Hey, yeah, Dave. Yeah. How's things down at Crazy Bob's car yard? What? You got another one? 400,000 on the clock. Deal. I'll take it.
Oh, brother.
I'll be right back, dude. I think I can argue them down to $10 for this one.
All right. Thanks, guys. And now we have another edition of Rob's Aviation Minute.
From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark, and this is the Aviation Minute. The other day, I was thinking about my early days as a working flight instructor. I remember hanging out with a bunch of other instructors at Palwaukee Airport, grousing about how we'd live on the $5 an hour we could get paid if we were able to sit in the right seat of a Cessna 150 long enough. Then one day, we heard about this guy on the airport who was willing to instruct for free. I mean, zero, zip, nada, just because he loved flying so much. He had another job, so he didn't really care much about the money, I guess. I can tell you, the rest of us instructors didn't much like the idea of a competitor undercutting our prices. There was a lesson, though, about pilot wages I took from this experience after one of the other guys told me not to worry about that instructor. Hey, he said,
The guy may get a few students, sure. But don't you think they'll be paying him what both his students and that instructor think they're worth? I never forgot that, actually. So on to today's topic, the lousy pay at the regional airlines. Many people are still wondering how it can possibly continue. But first, a little context. Most of the regional airline groups in the United States serve more than one airline. But because there aren't very many of those regional airline groups left in the United States, nor are there very many major carriers left, the competition becomes really cutthroat. That means those carriers are looking for ways to keep their costs low, and the first place they look, you got it, pilot wages. Let's compare Envoy, the old American Eagle carrier, with the mainline pilots at American Airlines. You may have heard recently that the American mainline pilots, represented by the Allied Pilots Association, just signed a new contract, one that gives them an immediate 23% pay hike and 3% annual raises after that. Not bad. But then American Airlines pulled down some serious profits the past few years, including the recent windfall off the drop in fuel prices. A point about those percentages, though. Long before AA sought bankruptcy protection a few years ago, their pilots took pay and benefit cuts worth about 35% to help the company stay afloat. This, of course, was happening while AA management was lining its own pocket with some hefty bonuses, cash payouts that eventually cost those folks their jobs. By the way, that kind of management behavior, well, it happens a lot more than you think, actually, and it's one reason pilots and management have never gotten along very well at any airline. But back to the Envoy pilots, who just signed a contract that freezes their already measly wages for at least another 10 years. So despite being represented by the Airline Pilots Association, the Envoy pilots are now guaranteed to remain poor for at least another decade. However, that's not the only reason regional pilots are so poorly paid. The pilots have a hand in this. If regional airline management came to understand that pilots wouldn't work for these awful wages, rates that enable some of them to qualify for food stamps, something would have to give. Perhaps the main lines would need to pay more for their regional feeds, or perhaps ticket prices would need to go up, or maybe the cheapskate regionals might even be forced to shut down. But remember, regional pilots don't need to accept the wages they're offered. And until they begin refusing this kind of pay, I guess we can only say that, well, maybe they too seem to know what their efforts are worth. From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark. We'll see you next time. And be sure to visit the Aviation Minute Archive at jetwine.com if you'd like to catch up on some past episodes.
Boy, it just seems like a pretty big problem. I mean, the wages are so low. I don't know how it's sustainable.
Well, it is for the reason, I mean, let's face it, the companies set the wages. Yeah, that doesn't mean the employees have to accept it either, but they do.
Mm-hmm. All right. Excellent Aviation Minute, Rob. Thank you. All right. Now we've got the final installment from Juan Fernandez. This has been his Geeks on Ice series of aviation in Antarctica. And here's Juan's final report.
Hello, Geeks. This is Geeks on Ice reporter Juan Fernandez with this last report on Antarctic aviation for the season. I know some people have asked why only 7 reports. The main reason is that I wanted to produce one episode for every week I spend on the ice. 7 weeks might sound a lot, but it's nothing compared to the typical Antarctic support contractor who spends about 5 months of the year down in Antarctica, usually between early October to late February during the austral summer. A few of them even spend a full year when they decide to stay for the winter over months. Also, 7 is a nice number. There were the original 7 Mercury astronauts, and then, related to Antarctic exploration, there are the Lucky 7, the first 7 Americans to set foot on the geographic South Pole. Both of these groups are composed of men, and I could easily dedicate this report to either of these brotherhoods. But rather, I'm going to dedicate this report to 7 women of a huge sisterhood. Lisa, Liz, Bev, Erin, Sarah, Jamini, and Claire. Women that work in roles that ranges from NSF program manager to aircraft dispatcher, a high school teacher to a cook, but who all work hard alongside many dedicated women and men to further Antarctic exploration. For a final report, I guess it's proper to talk a bit of my return to Christchurch. The flight was on an LC-130 and it lasted for about 8 hours. And even when it wasn't a really uncomfortable jump seat, I considered the flight as being first class. For one, I had infinite legroom. Please take a look at the internet page of this report for a photo inside of our LC-130. As you can see, there were only two jump seat rows that ran along the walls of the fuselage from the front all the way to the cargo ramp. Along the center line, a few cargo boxes and some of our own carry-on luggage was loaded, so we had all the room we wanted needed to stretch our legs. However, the main reason I say the flight was first class was because it fulfilled my dream of flying a Hercules on skis. But anyway, I don't want this last report on Geeks on Ice to be a goodbye, focusing on my return flight. Rather, I want to reflect on the possibility of returning to Antarctica someday. And to do that, I want to go full circle and focus on the beginning. From the beginning of Antarctic aviation and all the way to literally the beginning of the universe. So to do this, I want to talk a little bit about lighter-than-air flight. The first ever aircraft to fly in Antarctica was a balloon. It was taken there as part of Robert Falcon Scott's Discovery Antarctic Expedition in 1901 to 1904. Captain Scott made the first ascent on the Theodore hydrogen balloon on February 4, 1902, becoming the first man to fly the Antarctic skies to a height of about 800 feet. A second attempt of the same balloon happened the same day, lifting Ernest Shackleton up in the air to take the first ever aerial photographs of Antarctica. Balloons continue to fly in Antarctica today, from small weather balloons to huge long-duration balloons, or LDBs, that carry scientific instrumentation to study the deepest secrets of the universe. The particular stratospheric and anticyclonic wind patterns present around the geographic South Pole, coupled with the continuous 24-hour solar illumination during the summer that produce very little thermal gradients, allow balloons to stay in the air for long periods of time. Current record is 55 days, while maintaining a very constant altitude as high as 100,000 feet as they orbit around the pole. These are perfect conditions to test space hardware. To take advantage of these conditions, NASA maintains a balloon launch facility in McMurdo Station, known by locals as simply LDV, which is located 2 miles to the east of Williams Field. I was able to witness the launch of the last balloon of the 2014-2015 season on New Year's Day of 2015 that carried Spider, which is a very complex astronomical instrument that is trying to see the effects of gravitational waves as they move across the very faint surface of the cosmic microwave background radiation, which constitutes the fingerprint of the start of our universe, the Big Bang. So through these 7 weeks, we have talked about the men and women that make Antarctic aviation happen and that are helping scientists from around the world study the early stages of our solar system by finding meteorites from helicopters or study the early stages of our universe with balloons. To these unnamed heroes, my respect, admiration, and thanks for continuing to fuel the av geek and science geek inside me. Hasta pronto.
Thanks so much, Juan. This has been a really popular series with our listeners. We've gotten a lot of good positive feedback and quite a few people who've been, disappointed that it's kind of coming to a close, at least for now.
Well,
so.
You know what? I have to say, I'm disappointed.
You are? When? Why is that, Rob?
I've actually been disappointed since this whole thing started. I mean, exploration at the South Pole. I mean, come on, Juan, give me a break. Everybody knows the polar bears are at the North Pole. Yeah. What else is there to see?
Oh, Rob, what are we going to do with you?
Well, you know what? I think I found the solution for him because, if we're done with Juan Fernandez, I think that Rob should take over reporting from on the ice.
Yeah, there we go. We should send
Rob, you know, I think my Skype connection's cutting out there, Max. I'm losing you.
Weren't you just telling us about slipping on the ice in Chicago? You're the perfect guy for this.
Yeah, and there are no polar bears here either. No, actually, Juan, nice job, buddy. Really, I can't imagine what it must be like to see that down there.
Yeah, just what an adventure, you know, a lifetime adventure of a lifetime for sure. All right, let's move on to some listener mail. We'll start out really quickly with a voicemail that we got from Hendrik. Hendrik is from Germany, and he sends us this message about his visit to the United States. So here's Hendrik.
Hello, geeks. This is Hendrik coming to you from Hamburg in Germany, home of one of the two large Airbus factories in Europe and all sorts of other aviation-related industry. I've been working in aviation for quite some time, but I've never been much of a history guy. But still, all your stories about history museums in the United States made me very curious. And so last December, I did take a small trip over to the United States to visit Florida and Washington, D.C. Originally, I'd only planned to visit the Kennedy Space Center and Disney down in Florida, but as it turned out, right at the time that we were there, the Orion capsule was launched, and what a sight that was. Afterwards, we went on to Washington, D.C., where we spent a few days walking around the Smithsonian Museums, and especially a whole day at the Udvar-Hazy Center near the airport. And it was an amazing place for everyone who loves airplanes, so I can highly recommend it. During the visit to the Udvar-Hazy Center, I was reminded of a technology museum that we have over here in Germany, in the town of Sinsheim, which is located near Frankfurt. I'm not sure if anyone has ever mentioned it on the show, so I thought I'd bring it up. They have everything from huge steam train engines, Formula One cars, tanks, but the centerpieces, at least from my point of view, are 60 airplanes, including a classic Ju-52 and firefighting airplanes. But the most interesting airplanes are located on the roof of the museum. There you'll find Air France Concorde and the Soviet counterpart, the Tupolev 144. And the special thing is that you can actually go and walk into them. So unlike at the Udvar-Hazy Center, you can actually go into them and take a look around and see the flight decks and how people sat at the time when these supersonic airplanes cross the Atlantic all the time. So I would like to invite all of you to come over to beautiful Europe and, if you're in the area, maybe stop by this wonderful museum. I'll provide the link for further information for the show notes. That leaves me only to say, keep up all the good work, geeks. I love listening to your show every week, and talk to you soon. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you, Hendrik. This museum that he's referring to in Sinsheim is really fascinating. As he says, we'll put the link to that in the show notes and take a look at it. Some really interesting displays they have there. Well done. So thank you, Hendrik. We also got a voicemail from Nick. Actually, he asks a question. So let's listen to Nick's question.
Hey guys, I had a question about something talked about on the last episode about Air Force One and how the Air Force decided to go with the Boeing 747-8 as the next Air Force One aircraft. Something David had mentioned was that one of the main reasons why they went with that aircraft was because of the four-engine requirement. Now, my question to you guys is, I believe there is a 757 that is also used as Air Force One right now, and I know that Obama flies into Miami every now and then on that 757. So I was wondering if that four-engine requirement is something new or what. So look forward to your response. I look forward to the next episode. Keep up the great work, and we'll see you guys later. Thanks.
Well, thanks for the question, Nick. I asked David the question, and I haven't heard back from him yet, but as far as I know, the 757 is generally Air Force Two, right? Used for the vice president.
Yes. I've seen that airplane in Jackson Hole, Wyoming when former VP Cheney was there, and I think it's because they've got a shorter runway there. But it's remarkable. You know, it was a very cold day, and you look at the airplane, there was like no security around it. Now, granted, I'm sure I couldn't have got onto the airplane, but, you know, it looked very nonchalant there sitting on the runway or on the tarmac.
And I understand that Obama uses that sometimes. My understanding was generally when the Air Force One, the 747, is too large for wherever the destination, wherever they're flying to. And so sometimes they'll use the 757 for Obama, in which case it becomes Air Force One. But I don't think the four-engine requirement is new, just that sometimes they have to use the 757. And I don't know, maybe there are other times, other instances where the president uses the 757 instead of the 74 for some other reasons, but I'm just not sure what those might be.
Well, we've got a lot of smart listeners. Let's ask them.
Yeah.
Somebody can probably tell us.
Let us know. TheGeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Send us an email and let us know if you know more than we do. And until we hear back from David, who I'm sure knows all of this. Just quickly, We got an email from Bill. This was in reference to our episode 331, where we talked with Peter Young, the jet-setting terrorist. And this was about being on the watch list, on the terrorist list. And this is an article that we'll put in the show notes, a link we'll put in the show notes. Dutch game developer misses flight because of unreal Air Canada security boondoggle. And this is the tale of a guy who had or who ended up with that same SSSS designation on his boarding pass that Peter Young always has. And this was a case where, well, I guess it was kind of a messed up situation, and he shouldn't have been tagged like that. But it details the adventures that he went through with Air Canada as a result of this. So look for that in the show notes. And then Ray sent us a link. This is from AvWeb. Selfie may have contributed to crash. Now, this is from an NTSB report about the crash of a Cessna 150 last year in May of 2014, which the pilot and a passenger was killed. And apparently there's some evidence that it may have been, distracted flying.
That particular accident, they had video that was taken from the flight just before the actual fatal flight. They have no video from the actual fatal flight. And apparently during the prior flight, he was taking selfies. And so from that, they thought that, well, maybe he was doing that on the fatal flight as well. But I think the report says that there is no evidence that he was taking selfies on the actual fatal flight. Though, of course, all the headlines talk about selfies. So that's a little misleading.
So thanks for that, Ray. Chris sent us an email. Chris says, thanks for the excellent podcast. In a recent mention of an airplane boneyard, it led him to some online research, he said, where he discovered that Kingman, Arizona has a boneyard, and that this boneyard was adjacent to a manufacturing plant that he was visiting. So he says, I enjoyed driving around the periphery of this boneyard and appreciating the planes visible, from the DC-4 with pink livery to older regional jets from Delta, United, American, as well as DHL cargo planes. He said there were a few more exotic planes as well, exotic to him anyway, representing airlines, he says, including Astar, Linden Air Cargo, California Pacific, and Passeredo. So I took a look around, and I knew that there were some great websites for some of these boneyards, and there's actually something called airplaneboneyards.com. And if you're interested in that topic or want to see a lot of information about airplane boneyards, you can visit that site, airplaneboneyards.com.
I got a few comments about boneyards.
Yes, Don.
Well, you know, one of the problems is you have to document the parts, where the parts have been. And some boneyards will have the original logbooks of the airplane, and then you could document how much, where the parts came from, that they're genuine. But the fact is, if you get a part from a salvage yard or a boneyard and want to put it on an airplane, the mechanic might not put it on for you, because by putting that on the airplane, he's certifying that that part is airworthy. Now, if it comes along with a document, like the FAA part release form, and it's called the FAA Form 8130 or yellow tag in the past, if it comes along with that, the liability is on the person who checked the part out, not the mechanic putting the part on the airplane. So a lot of people buy used parts, and the mechanics don't want to put it on. And then they say, well, that mechanic wants to make more money by putting new parts on because they get a commission. Well, that's true, but that's not always the case. Mechanic doesn't want to take that liability.
Yeah, that's right. The paperwork is everything in this business, for sure. 8130 is an important document, as you say, Don. And if you're missing that, and if you don't have the maintenance records, that's, you know, the part might as well be scrap in many cases. And as just a final item, we received a press release. This came from Leah Block. And coming up in this year, let's see, this is in May, there is the 70th anniversary of VE Day, Victory in Europe Day. And there's going to be a flyover in Washington, D.C. It's the Arsenal of Democracy, World War II Victory Capital Flyover. You can learn more about that at www.flyover.org. And this sounds just amazing. Just briefly, it says the flyover will include 15 historically sequenced warbird formations traveling across the Capitol from the Lincoln Memorial to the Capitol. It says the flyover will feature over 70 warbirds representing the major battles of World War II. It ends with a final missing man formation to Taps. I don't know about you guys, but anytime I see one of those, man, it just brings tears to my eyes. Just sort of, very emotional, I think. So we'll put a link, actually a couple of links to some information about this flyover. Again, that's May 2015 in Washington, D.C. This sounds like a must-see kind of an event if you're going to be in that area. All right. Well, with that, we want to thank you for listening to this episode 336 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Find us at airplanegeeks.com, on Twitter at Airplane Geeks. We're also on Facebook and Google, Stitcher.com, and TuneIn Radio. If you want to send us an email, that's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. So let's tell folks where they can find us online. We haven't done this in a little while. Rob, Mark, we'll start with you. Where do folks find more Rob?
Well, let's see. They find me here in the recording studio, but since most of them aren't here, except for Simba the Wonder Dog, which Steve and Grant know about very well, it's usually at jetwine.com, Jetwine on Twitter, my name on Facebook, I don't know where else. Of course, the Aviation Minute, which is tied to Jetwine, and some of the magazines, and who knows where else, just so long as it's not in jail.
Yeah, good. Max Trescott, where do people find you?
Well, if they wander out to the Palo Alto airport, they can often find me teaching there, but I think you're talking about online kinds of things. They can find me at g1000book.com, maxtrescott.com, or even on Facebook, Max Trescott.
All right, very good. And we want to give a special thanks to our guest, Don Sebastian, President of Aviation Consulting Services. Don, give us that phone number where folks can reach you.
Yes, sir. You can't find me online because it takes so much time answering all those emails. So I need it. It's a personal service. So you call me and we talk about your situation. And my phone number is 910-315-0099.
All right, Don. Thanks again. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. You can find me at the UAVDigest.com for the unmanned aerial vehicle podcast I do with David Vanderhoof. Also, PaxXPodcast.com for the passenger experience podcast I do with Mary Kirby. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at BrotherLoveRocks.com. So, join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, keep the blue side up.
Yep, good night.
People are getting a little outraged. So.
That's exactly right, Grant. In fact, I think that should be one for the files.
Oh, let's see if Max leaves that one in.
I've just put that in the outtakes. Thank God.
Weird.